In Thailand, they always mix their R's and their L's. So we have this saying, "Are you lady?" And they... No, I am a man. Okay. I want to split the room up into three groups. First group, so you can stay where you are, just a theoretical split. First group, people who hate going to the dentist. Second group, people who don't mind going to the dentist. And the third group, people who like going to the dentist. Okay, so raise your hand if you hate going to the dentist. Okay, raise your hand if you like going to the dentist. Oh wow, a few people. It's probably because you're dentists, right? Okay, so this is significant, and we'll come to the significance of the dentist a little bit later on. So I am a Pandit. I have been a monk for 15 years. I live in Thailand. We have a small, similar kind of group in Thailand, a kind of Buddhist fellowship-like group. It's a bit smaller and less organized, but we do the best that we can. And I've been in Singapore for a couple of weeks, and I'm going home tomorrow. So that's my background. We're here then to, as we gather as groups interested in Buddhism, we're here interested in this idea of enlightenment. We've been told, or we've heard that there is something called enlightenment. And this is many different descriptions of enlightenment: the supreme refuge, the supreme freedom from bondage, the ending of all suffering for yourself, not for the whole world. Liberation, the ending of the outflowing of the mind, the end of the asava is called kinasava, the ending of the outflowing of the mind. So many different descriptions for what enlightenment is. It's also deathless, which means it's something that doesn't die. So it's a kind of immortality, but it doesn't mean that the body and you will become immortal. It means there's something in you that is immortal, some kind of essence that doesn't change. In Mahayana Buddhism, we call it Buddha nature. And there they say, all beings have Buddha nature. The theory goes that once you've heard about this, then it lodges as a seed in your psyche, in your consciousness, and that ever after you will never find the world satisfying again. So I've just ruined the rest of your life for you. You'll never find the world satisfying because you know or you've heard that there is something that's ultimately satisfying, something that's ultimately good, something that's ultimately worth achieving over and above anything else that you can find. And once we have this idea, then it's kind of with us all the time. And whenever we're engaging in activity in the world, we always have this background knowledge or understanding that this isn't it. Just getting through the argument with my husband or my wife, that isn't it. That's not going to be ultimate happiness. Getting through this school year, getting through this downturn in the economic cycle, and all the rest of it, this isn't going to be the ultimate happiness. So we have in mind that there is some other ultimate, and the saying goes that once you've heard about it, then you're on the path, and that sooner or later you're going to follow this path and become enlightened. So in the Tibetan tradition, they say anybody who's heard even one word of the Lotus Sutra, you're guaranteed to become perfectly enlightened. Okay, doesn't matter how long it takes, but sooner or later you're guaranteed perfect enlightenment. So I'm going to tell you one word that's in the Lotus Sutra so that you're all guaranteed enlightenment. And that word is "and." So the word "and" is somewhere there in the Lotus Sutra, and now you've heard it, you're guaranteed to become enlightened. In India, they have a mountain, Arunachala. Has anyone been there to Arunachala, Ramana Maharshi's place? One or two people have. They say if you walk around the mountain, you're guaranteed enlightenment. So that's what you do. That's the thing, you know. You go to Florida, you do Disney World. You go to India, you walk around Arunachala Mountain. And I walked around. You start off early in the morning. Actually, to tell you the whole story, I'd gone there with a crazy American guy who fancied himself as a bit of a spiritual guru or meditator or something. And he was very proud, and this is the funny thing, he's very proud of going around India with no shoes. So barefoot, going. He's American, he's there kind of on holiday, but going around with no shoes, and it's like, shoes are like terrible, and if you want to be religious, you can't wear shoes. And, you know, that's not true. I mean, Indians don't wear shoes when they can't afford them. If you can afford them, you wear shoes. It's a sensible thing to do. And we'll have a little story later on about how shoes came into being, the first ever shoe in the world. So when we climbed up Arunachala Mountain, we went to see the cave where Ramana Maharshi, this Indian guru who most of us believe was enlightened, where he used to stay. And this American said, you can't wear your shoes going up the mountain. He said, it's a holy mountain. And, you know, the locals, they might not beat you up, but they'll look down on you. And so you can't. And I, like an idiot, I let him convince me. So off we went, walking up this mountain. His feet were like thick and black because he's been doing it for a long time. And my feet were fresh from England. The only time my feet had seen the outside of a sock was when I have a bath. So this time in India, I peel my socks off. It's like birthing little pink baby twins. And so I'm going up this mountain, and, you know, it ruined the whole trip because every step I was, ow, ooh, ah, ooh. And he was just kind of looking at me, well, you know, you can't possibly wear shoes. We must have seen about 40 people up there, and many of them were locals, and every single one of them was wearing shoes. So when we walked around the mountain the next day, we actually got rid of this American. He was a little bit too much, and there's a few people, and we got together, and we left at 4 in the morning before he got up. He might wear no shoes, but he tends to sleep in late, so can't be that holy. So we walked around the mountain, and it takes about 6 hours. And as you go around, there's a lot of thorns. There's no path. And it's like a dry desert in India. And there's a lot of, like, thorny bushes. And I just had tennis shoes, and it's like light tennis shoes. And the thorns are even coming through the shoes. And every so often, you have to stop and pluck these thorns out of your shoes. So we got all the way around the mountain, and then he caught up with us a few hours later, and was like, where were you this morning? And we're like, oh, weren't you coming today? Oh, I didn't know that. And then he said, so have you walked around the mountain? We said, yes. And then I just got this picture in my head of him walking around this mountain with no shoes. All these thorns going through his feet. And I must admit, it was a rather gratuitous fun that I had with that, playing with that image in my mind. So what is it that makes something holy? What is it that we have to do to reach this thing called enlightenment? This unconditioned, this deathless state of supreme bliss, supreme security from bondage that we've been told about, not just by the Buddha, but in fact by many different teachers and many different gurus. I mentioned last week about how even the Buddha had heard about this before he went and became enlightened. He had heard that there is this thing called enlightenment. And they called it the amata, the deathless. So if this thing is unconditioned, it means it doesn't matter what you do, you can't attain it. You can't change your mind from one state into another state, and then you create this sense of this enlightenment. Any state of mind that you can create is something that's born and it's going to die. So whatever enlightenment is, it's something that lies prior to all of the states of mind. So in order to get deep into the mind, what we do is we practice silence. We practice quieting the mind down. The main tool for this is wisdom, and wisdom arises through self-knowing. So nearly all spiritual paths that are genuine have as a basis somewhere this sense of self-knowing, know thyself. From that self-knowing, if you can see and observe yourself, then slowly but surely you start to disentangle the tangled mind. As you disentangle, then you start to get these deeper and deeper senses of peace and stillness. And this is the path that we're trying to practice. So to get to this sense of stillness, we do all kinds of kind of tricks and meditations. And if we remember that this stillness, this awareness, is what we're trying to really cultivate, all the other traditions, all the other rites and rituals that we do are something that helps with that. So whether you wear shoes or you don't wear shoes is not the point. If you really want to wear no shoes and you use it as a practice, as a reminder for, you know, to getting the mind into the silence, then it's a good practice. If, on the other hand, you think that wearing shoes makes you better than, not wearing shoes makes you better than everyone else, then it's just going to be another source of ego. And so it is with all these different practices that we do. If you attach to them in the wrong way, they're just going to be another way of feeding your ego. All of these practices, if you approach them in the right way, they can be used as tools, they can be used as methods to take you beyond yourself, out past yourself and into the silence, into that sense of simply being. This is what they do with a church, for example. When they build a huge cathedral, you know, these towering cathedrals. Remember back in the day when they were building cathedrals, they were very hard to build. They didn't have our modern materials. And the architecture was something quite special to be able to put these huge roofs up and open up these huge spaces. That's why they had the stained glass windows and the organ going, so that when you come in, you're just like, wow. We do the same thing, but in the mind. When we come in and we do meditation, we bringing the mind back, being willing to give up the thoughts and to simply be, to simply cultivate that sense of awareness, that sense of mindfulness. In the first steps, mindfulness is mindful of what you're doing, so you keep your mind in the present moment. So if you're painting the wall, you just paint the wall. If you're driving your car, you just drive the car. I don't know if you know that one story about the meditation teacher. He used to teach like this: if you're walking down the road, just walk down the road. If you're painting the wall, you just paint the wall. If you're hanging the wallpaper, just hang the wallpaper. And then one of his students went into the building in the morning, and they saw him sitting at the breakfast table, eating his breakfast and reading the paper. And they said, "But teacher, you know, what are you doing here?" And the teacher said, "If you're eating your breakfast and reading the paper, just eat your breakfast and read the newspaper." So the first step is to bring the mind, bring your attention to what you're doing. But even that isn't it either. After a while, you get this sense of simply the awareness, simply that light, brightness of the mind, that self-consciousness. And you learn to split the times when you're doing something while you have that awareness and when you lose it. And most of the time you lose your awareness in what you're doing. You get caught up in the things that you're doing, so you lose that awareness of yourself. I think last week I gave the example of a kid playing a computer game, or me on Photoshop, and you just get sucked in, and you know, for hours and hours I can spend on Photoshop just like sucked into the computer. Think about what your sense of time is like when you're getting absorbed into something like that. Right? You lose all sense of your time, right? Or the sense of passing time. So you get absorbed and you're just doing the Photoshop, and the next thing you look up and 3 hours have gone by. And, you know, it's like, where did that 3 hours go? Well, it must have been working on Photoshop. Or you're driving your car a long way. In England, you get onto the motorway. You don't have very long roads in Singapore. But in England, you get onto the motorway and then you switch off on the brain, and then 4 hours later you realize you missed your turn off several hours ago. It's actually happened to me. There's two motorways in England on each side of the country. And if you're going on the west side, which is where I live, you have to switch motorways and go up the west side. I got on the motorway and I just went all the way up and then got to Sheffield, and I should have been in Manchester, and there's a mountain range in between. So what was I doing all that time? I'm driving a car. Surely I have to be awake and aware to drive a car. Actually, it's not true. You can drive a car on autopilot. If you've trained your mind sufficiently to drive a car, your neural circuits can take over and manage that action while you are off thinking. And the curious thing about this is your neural circuits, or your subconscious neural circuits, will handle tasks much better than you can. So when you're training yourself to do something, it's always very difficult to train yourself in the beginning. You think about learning to drive a car. You had the clutch, you had the brake, you had the accelerator, you had the gears, you had the indicator, you had to check your rear view mirror, check your wing mirror, and you had to look over your shoulder, and then you indicate, and then you move, and you're not allowed to cross your hands on the steering wheel. You probably all have automatics now, don't you? You don't use clutches and gear sticks anymore, but I had to learn the hard way. And it's confusing, and your feet get tied up, and you hit the windscreen wipers instead of the indicators, and then you forget to look in the mirror, and your driving instructor shouts at you, and it's hard to juggle these like 20 or 30 operations. And yet, once you've learned how to drive, what do? Work. That's it. And then your body just takes over, and it indicates, it looks in the mirror, and it drives out and does it automatically. You don't notice the changing of the gear and the moving of the feet, unless something goes wrong. That's because the automated circuits in the brain, the way that the brain works, is when you're learning something new, you learn with consciousness and attention. But when you've learned something, it passes into subconscious routines. So if you're think of a sportsman, somebody playing tennis, you'd think they have to be supremely conscious and aware, right, of what they're doing. Actually, it's not true. They practice what they're doing until they don't need to be aware of it anymore. Their conscious is still there. They have this vivid sense of wakefulness because they can't be thinking about other things. You know, you don't see Serena Williams worrying about what to make for dinner while she's on the court of Wimbledon. Did she win this year? Who won this year? Huh? She won. Okay. I remember seeing her in the final. So her consciousness is there, but the routines to play tennis have all had to be ingrained. Me, myself, one of my guilty pleasures is boxing. I follow boxing. And what you do in boxing is called reps. And there's only like 12 ways that you can swing at another person, and there's 18 ways that you can defend. So the boxers do this over and over and over and over again so that they're learning with the body. And eventually when they get into the ring, they can't be thinking like, shall I do this one or this one? Shall I dodge this way or shall I block or shall I duck? It all has to be automatic. So your automated processes tend to rule the life. And if you're going to develop any skill, you have to pass it from conscious into subconscious in order for it to work. Now, that's just the way that human beings work. If you want the psychology of it all, I can give you quite a lot of the psychological testing that's been done on this. For example, the driving the car is actually called highway hypnosis. And it's a registered phenomenon in psychology that we study. However, the problem is that because most of your routines then can be undergone subconsciously, what happens is much of your life is then subconscious, is that you're not really aware of the passing of time or the passing of the day. Just every so often you look up and like, oh, I better go to work. And then, you know, at work and you're spending 2 hours on Facebook, and then you think, oh, I'd better do some actual work. And you know, I've noticed this because I do the PR in Bangkok and I send out to the emailing list, right? And on the emailing list, if people click on the link in the emails and come to look at the website, I can see how many people have clicked, right? So I've done some experiments. What is the best time to email everybody so that they'll click on it and see the link? Any ideas? Evening? In the morning? Which morning? Okay. What I found the best time to send the email out is late, very late on Thursday night, 3 o'clock in the morning. Because everybody wants to get all their emails done on a Friday, so they're free for the weekend. So while they're at work on a Friday, that's when they're checking their emails, and that's when they all link to the website. If I send it on Friday night and they get the emails for Saturday or Sunday morning, they don't click on it till they get to work on Monday. Then I see all the links coming in. So mostly life is handled by these subroutines, and so that means that most of the time we're not really aware. Children are not like this. Do you remember Sundays when you were a child, when you were a very young child? Sundays used to like go on and on and on and on, like all day long. Now what are your Sundays like as an adult? Just like, psh, you're back at work, right? What's the difference? What's the difference in the child's Sunday and your Sunday? The child doesn't get lost in these routines. They're always awake, they're always aware, they're always looking at something. And the more often you have that wakefulness, the more you have the sense of time passing. So if you go on a meditation retreat, hopefully you feel like the day just stretches on and on and on, because you keep bringing your mind back, you keep cultivating this sense of awareness. If you're just getting lost in stuff, you know, like you wake up on a Sunday and you have that extra hour in bed, and then you're out working around the house or on the computer or whatever it is that you have to do, and your day's gone before you know it. So with the mindfulness, what you're doing is you're interrupting these processes. This is why in the meditation I say do it 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, catching the mind having wandered off and bringing it back. It's that catching the mind that's important. It's not that you should sit here and just be aware of the breathing and everything else disappears and everything becomes bright and beautiful and wondrous, and then the rest of the day you're floating around on a cloud. If that happens to you, you probably need a psychiatrist more than you need more than you need a meditation hall. It's the more often you catch the mind having wandered away, that's the moment when mindfulness is really there. So you catch the mind and you bring it back. You're paying worship to the silence. You're paying worship to the stillness. Because anything that's distracting you from that stillness, you're now seeing as distraction. So most of your life you spend and you're doing the things that you have to do. And while the mind is moving around, you consider it, this is me. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And or at least if everything's going right, you consider it me. If everything's going wrong, you consider it, you know, somebody else's fault. So while everything's going right, you feel that this is me. But when you come to sit in meditation, what happens? Okay, sit, meditate, focus on the breathing, and your mind has other ideas. And it says, no, I'm going to think about this, I'm going to think about this, I'm going to jump over here, jump over there. The mind carries on by habit. But you've fundamentally changed your attitude towards yourself. In the daily life, your mind thinks something, you feel it's you thinking and doing. When you do meditation, you see your mind doing something you don't want it to do. You're seeing the mind not as yourself. You're seeing the mind as something that you can experience. And people really miss this. People say, I want to meditate. Oh, my mind's not doing what I want it to do. That's the insight. Knowing or seeing that the mind is not doing what you want it to do, that was the insight that you were looking for. This is the meaning of non-self. When we talk about non-self in Buddhism, it doesn't mean that you don't have a self. Of course you have a self. You have an age, you have a character, you have a personality, you have characteristics. That's yourself. And the Buddha didn't dispute that. And in fact, he said you should develop yourself. So develop your good qualities and reduce your bad qualities. What we mean by non-self is you start to see these aspects of the mind not as you. So you see the mind doing this or that and it's out of control. You sit down and tell your mind, okay, just focus on the breathing, and your mind goes, nope, I've got other ideas, I'm going to go and think about this and this and this. Now you're seeing the mind not as yourself. So that was the real insight. As the mind latches onto something, you notice that. That's attachment right there, when the mind latches onto something. When you let go of that something, that's non-attachment. Mind comes back to the silence, worshipping the silence. In one way, shape or form, every genuine spiritual tradition will have certain rules, rites, rituals and forms in order to take you back to this silence. It's not that one form is right and another form is wrong. It's getting back to this stillness of the mind that is important. This stillness, this wakefulness of mind. That's what we're actually trying to develop. So in Thailand we have a lot of different colours of the robes. I actually wear the orange colour, the bright orange colour, normally. It's just for the pleasantness of your eyes that I change into a nice quiet brown colour for you. But when I go back tomorrow, I'm back in my day glow orange, which they always joke is very useful if you're walking along the street at night. It's a lot safer. Or if you have a skiing accident, it's very safe if you're in the orange robes rather than your brown robes. Is this color robe or that color robe going to get you enlightened? Is wearing shoes or not wearing shoes going to get you enlightened? Yeah. Does bowing three times, we bow on our knees and we bow the 5-point prostration, two knees, two hands and the head touching the ground. Tibetans, they bow full body length, right? Standing up, lying down, standing up, lying down. Are people who do standing up, lying down, are they going to get enlightened, but us five-pointers, we're not going to get enlightened because we didn't bow properly? It's crazy, right? Yet people get so attached to the rites and rituals and the schools and this school versus that school. So we come back to this idea of worshipping the silence. That's what's important. All these rites and rituals and traditions are there to take us back to this stillness, the brightness, the alertness, the wakefulness of the mind. And this actually is my own practice at the moment. And some people think that, well, if you've been a monk for 15 years, you must be in this really deep, intricate practice. Maybe you've measured maybe you've memorized the 52 jhetasika and the 89 states of consciousness in the 42 kinds of being across the 36 sense doors. And no, I did all that when I was younger. And you tend to do things more and more simple. So my practice at the moment is what they call the slayer. And the Buddha said that if you're practicing enlightenment, practicing for enlightenment, you need to keep it in mind like a slayer with an upraised sword. So a slayer is someone who's going to murder people, cut people up with their sword. Is this the kind of imagery you associate with the Buddha? This is his own image. He said you should be keep in mind the idea of enlightenment like a slayer with an upraised sword. So the slayer with the upraised sword, he's there ready to strike, to defend himself at all times. He's not standing there with his upraised sword wondering what's for dinner tonight, you know, what's on TV, and you know, have you watched the new season of Dallas? Have you? Right, he's ready there. He's ready to strike. In my mind, it's Luke Skywalker. You know, he's there, ready with his lightsaber. So we're keeping in mind this kind of practice means to keep enlightenment then, or this mindfulness, this wakefulness in mind the whole time. So I'm trying, that's my current practice. If I'm sitting in a car with you, and you think that we're talking about something, you're talking about something, my automated processes are replying to you, but my consciousness is there, awake, sharp. Every so often, of course, I lose awareness, and then I bring my attention back, and I maintain the awareness. So that's kind of my practice at the moment. Doesn't sound very exciting, right? We were talking this morning with the youth group, like, how do they make the youth group more exciting and more interesting to bring in new members? And they were pointing out, the youths were pointing out, that you have to strike a balance between jazzing it up and making it exciting, and maybe you sing a few songs and dance a few dances, and and things, but you've got to balance that with Dharma. If you just make it too exciting and, you know, too much of a distraction, then you lose the Dharma, which is what we're coming together to practice in the first place. So there are all kinds of ways. You know that movie was the, what's it called, the Rings movie? Lord of the Rings? Yeah, so when that came out, I saw the Catholic Church would change it. So from the Lord of the Rings, they change it the Lord of all things. And what they're trying to do is tap into local media or tap into things that people already know and then associate it with the church. Actually, I think it's not a bad, program or PR program to do it like that. But ultimately, we have to give up this need for excitement, this need for interest, and be willing to put things down, let things go, and come back to the silence, come back to the quiet. Yeah, it's not that exciting. There's one time in Bangkok, I invited Dajahn Pasano to give a Dharma talk. And this was in the one of the big hotels in the middle of Bangkok. And I happened to know the maintenance manager for the hotel. This is intercontinental. This is a big, probably the poshest hotel in Bangkok. So maintenance manager is a huge job. I mean, he's a high position. And so we're arranging this talk with Ajahn Pasano inside the hotel, and I saw that my friend, and I won't tell you his name, but I saw that Rohan wasn't there for the Dharma talk. And so I called him up, and I said, because he lives there. I have lunch with him in his apartment inside the hotel. I said, why aren't you at the Dharma talk? And he went, oh, Bhante. He didn't expect me to call him up, you see. He said, because we're going to see Avatar. And I said, you can go and see a movie at any time. Little exciting movies, you can see at any time. This is a once a year opportunity to come and see Ajahn Pasano. And Rohan said, yes, but Bhante, it's in 3D. I said, Ajahn Pasano is in 3D as well. So we're always following something that's exciting. We want, we crave excitement, we crave interest, stimulation. One way, shape or form, we're going to have to use these traditions that we develop in order to take us back to this silence, take us back to this quiet. In that sense, then, the traditions are not really real per se. And I've noticed that a lot of you in Singapore have a little bit of confusion or trying to marry up these different traditions and the way the different monks or different teachers do things. And some of us do things one way and some will do it another way. For example, eating together in Thailand, the monks would always eat separately, but here I'm eating together with you, which is the right way to do it. You know, if a Thai comes along, they say, oh, Singaporeans, they don't know how to treat monks because you're eating together. And then we say, the Thais, why can't we eat together? We're talking about Dharma. It's a good thing. And even in Thailand, you do get this kind of discrepancy that some of the monks, we don't eat in the evening, but there's certain things that are allowed. So some temples will allow soya milk in the evening. And some temples won't. Some temples allow milk in the evening, but not soya milk. So where I live, you can have milk, but not soya milk. In the Ajahn Chah temples, you can have soya milk, but not milk. But then Wat Pa Pong banned soya milk because they didn't like it. So you can only have soya milk if you're in that group of temples outside of Thailand. One temple in center of Bangkok, Wat Bawon, different buildings have different rules. And they kind of glare at each other, you know, like those guys over there, they're no good. They have coffee mate in their coffee, you know. They can't possibly get enlightened. And this building, you know, they ban coffee. No, it's addictive. You can't have coffee. And so you have to get your coffee over here, then take it over to that building for your coffee mate, somewhere else to put sugar in it, and then you're okay. So all these different traditions, are they these different varieties, bear in mind that the traditions are only there as a form to bring people together, that we can go back to this stillness of the mind. The Buddha said the Dhamma is like a raft, something to be thrown away. You make a raft out of the bits and pieces around you, and then when you've crossed over, you throw it away. It's not the Dhamma itself or the raft itself is not what's important. What's important is that taking you towards enlightenment. So amongst all these different traditions, I know sometimes you guys, you see us from Thailand, and we have slightly different ways of doing things, and then you try and work out, well, which is the right temple? Is this the right temple? And these guys live in a forest, these guys live in a stately mansion, these guys live in Bangkok, these guys live outside of Bangkok, these guys wear orange, these guys study, these guys don't study, they meditate, these guys meditate half, study. Like, what? Which tradition is the right tradition? So bear in mind that all of these traditions are only forms to take you back to the stillness. They're just ways that we can come together and live together as a group in this temple or that temple. And between us, we don't really have any conflicts. Yes, we kind of peer over at other temples and, you know, there are things that we do better than they do and vice versa. But, you know, when we meet together, we don't have any kind of conflict. I come from you all know Ajahn Brahm. I come from a different set of temples, and we have different rules, and we use the Vinaya in a different way and in different interpretation. Originally, I was from the Amravati group of temples, and then I moved to Thailand. But, you know, when I meet Ajahn Brahm, we don't, like, look at each other and say, you do this, well, you do that. And of course not. We greet each other respectfully with appreciation for each other's practice. We respect that, you know, we're all on the path, and we help each other out. Ajahn Brahm, a couple of years ago, with all this stuff happened in Thailand, I met him here. I said right away, we'll set up Dhamma talks for you in Bangkok. He said, right, fine, thank you for the offer. It wasn't, no, you're from a different group, you wear orange, can't be any good. And so on for the rest of the group. You know, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Viradhamma, all these people within that group, they come and do talks for my group in Bangkok. I help them in different ways because Ajahn Jayasaro, he has kind of followers in Bangkok. So I organize trips so that they can get up to see him sometimes. So within the temples, within the monks and the monasteries, actually we don't have any kind of clash or any kind of problems with each other. They're just traditions that you use in this temple or that temple. And I like that. I like the fact that within the framework of Theravada Buddhism, which is a nice, clear, clean framework, there is room for some variance. If all the temples were the same, it would be a little bit boring. Some temples are really big on study. The temple where I come from, they insist that you learn Pali and the 3 years of Dhamma exams. I didn't want to do that. So I said to the abbot, I'd rather do the university course. So he said, fine, I'll allow that, but you have to move temples to go and live nearer to the university. So I moved. Other temples study Abhidhamma, and if you go in there, you have to study Abhidhamma. Some temples, you know, you have to get up at 3 a.m. and do 6 hours of meditation before the arms round. Other temples, you can get up whatever time of day you like. It's up to you. You maintain your own practice. So I like that there's a variance, that there's choice in the approaches. And it also gives monks and lay people chance to do different kinds of retreats, go with different kinds of teachers. I myself, I like to take time out, and I go and stay with my teacher in Chiang Mai. He just died a couple of days ago. He's quite old. He had Parkinson's. So I think it's not such a bad thing that he passed away at this point. And other times I'm really involved with our university, the Monks University, and that involved a lot of traveling and teaching in the classes. And so it's good that we can mix these things up. So while we're figuring out all of these methods, the right way, the wrong way, our way, the middle way, third way, or any which way that we can do to take us back to this silence, the stillness, which is the core of the practice. Yeah. So while you're figuring it out, the trick is not so much to figure out which way is the right way and the wrong way. The trick is really to fundamentally change your approach to life. Now, when you change your approach to life, I should stress that you should carry on doing exactly what you were doing before. Your friends and your family, really, when you're practicing Dharma, they shouldn't notice much difference in the way that you act. You don't want to suddenly decide you're going to practice Dharma and then sell everything in your house so that you just have blank walls and no ornaments and, no, I'm just going to be a meditator from now on. You don't want to make sudden drastic changes like that. You know, suddenly you sell all your suits and you dress in a loincloth and barefoot. Again, that kind of thing is all ego play. That's more ego play. So carry on doing what you were doing before, but you're changing the view. And what we're doing is bringing the mind into the momentary view. The momentary view means that, as I was saying before, most of the time people get lost or caught up in their activities. With mindfulness, you keep interrupting those activities and re-establishing wakefulness. And you can do that while you're working, while you're on the bus, while you're driving, while you're even watching TV, even, you know, cleaning the house, talking to friends, continually bringing your mind back, continually interrupting these automated processes that rule your life. When you interrupt them continually, you start to see yourself much more clearly. When most of your processes are, if you're interested in this, by the way, there's a very good book called Incognito, which talks about the neurology of automated processes, and it goes into this in a lot of very interesting detail if you're interested in psychology, neurology. So we're interrupting those processes over and over and over again. So what you have is you're still doing the same things you were doing before, but you've added this quality of mindfulness. You've added this quality of awareness. Like the slayer with the upraised sword, you always have that quality there, burning, bubbling away, in amongst your general activities. So the first step of mindfulness is be aware of what you're doing. The second step is you maintain the mindfulness despite what you're doing. Even amongst all the things that you're doing, you get this continual sense of mindfulness itself. So then, that's fundamentally changed your viewpoint. You're no longer trying to figure it out. And quite honestly, if you try and figure out Dharma, you're not going to do it. Attachment causes suffering. You know, I heard that, and I was always a little skeptical. What about teaching your kids? You teach your kids to try hard at school. That's a form of attachment. Is that suffering? You want to look after your kids and your children. You want to feed them and get them educated in the right way, teach them to be good people. Isn't that a form of attachment? Is that causing you suffering or your children suffering? Of course, there'll be some suffering there, but there's also a lot of happiness there, a lot of pleasure there. Is attachment really causing suffering? If you're... you know, your husband, your wife, your children get home and it's your job to make dinner and they come home and they say, what's for dinner? And you say, I don't know, I'm detached. You know, your kids, you know, your kids have to get up for school in the morning and you say, get up or don't get up, it's up to you, I'm detached. That's not what it was about. Right? You can't figure desire. Actually, I saw one time, I was struggling with this attachment causes suffering, and then I was on a train in India, and I saw this Japanese guy got on the train in India, and he had all these great cameras, as Japanese always do. And just as we were settling down for this long trip, he got out this chain, and he chained up all of his cameras and his camera cases, and then chained it around his leg. And I thought, attachment, that's attachment. There's chains to your leg. That's real attachment causing suffering. Turns out he was on the right track because I had my bag stolen. So, I took my eye off it for literally 30 seconds as we got on the train. I put it on the seat above me. 30 seconds, and I better get hold of it, and it had already gone. So desire is the cause of suffering in the is the root or the arising of suffering, second noble truth. Is that true? Don't you desire to pass exams? You desire to look after your children? You desire to make a nice home for your family, right? When you start applying Dharma on like a real worldly level, very often it doesn't make much sense. If you battle with it long enough, you can make sense out of it. And it's rather like hearing a song and you can't quite get the lyrics right, so you make something up. Like the Simon and Garfunkel song, The Only Living Boy in New York. And it starts off, Tom, I won't sing it, but Tom, get your plane right on time. I know you're part of the wolf line. Oh, that's great. What's a wolf line? That really appealed to my imagination. And I thought, a wolf line must be this secret organization. You know, there were secret handshakes and you know, sending messages to each other and organizing like these secretive things. I thought, great, the wolf line. And then years later, when the internet came about, I thought, you know, this song popped up in my head. I thought, I can find out what a wolf line is. And I looked it up, and I was completely wrong. It said, Tom, I know your part will go fine. I was gutted. It's like, no, what happened to my secret organization? And then, your part will go fine. Okay, your part in life will go fine. That's what I thought it meant. And I was doing this in the Dharma talk, and then one of my friends came up to me afterwards. He said, that's not the meaning of it. He said, the meaning was, Tom, Art Garfunkel was quitting Simon and Garfunkel and he was going to pursue a movie career, and he got a part in a movie, so this was Simon saying, you know, Tom or Art, your part in the movie is going to go fine. So and Dharma is a bit like this, actually. If you think, even something that doesn't make much sense, if you think long and hard about it, you seem to make a kind of sense out of it. You invent a whole story around it. The real meaning of attachment causes suffering is nothing to do with being attached to having a nice house, having nice children, dressing nice, attaching to Dharma, attaching to Dharma practice. That's not what it's about. When you switch the mind into the momentary view, so you're only looking at what's arising right here, right now, then you can feel attachment pulling you one way or another way. That you can let go of. The more you can let go of that, the more you have this sense of wakefulness and consciousness. Now that doesn't interfere with what we call aspirations. Aspirations in life, you keep going. You have aspirations to be a good person, aspirations to look after your children, aspirations to look after your husband and wife, aspirations to look after your health. Somebody actually once accused me when I... because I like to run around my building in the middle of the night, because it's about the only exercise that I can get, and everybody's asleep. And I have audiobooks, and I wear my headphones, and I run around the building, and I do my audiobooks, and kind of little ritual that I have. And I mentioned this, and someone said, no, you're just attached to the exercise. No, I want to be healthy. That's a normal, common sense aspiration to have. That's not an attachment. That's a common sense aspiration that I should maintain. I've thought about it, I've chosen to do it, and I'm going to keep it up. You know, some monks, especially like the forest monks, they're kind of really dirty robes, and they like to have robes for years and years, and they take great pride in never changing their robes out for new robes, and they'll patch them over and over again. They get grubbier and grubbier. And you know, for those of us in the city who do functions, we go to hospital, we see people who are dying, we see people who are sick, we see people who are getting married. And so we like to be clean. Some people say to me, you shouldn't wear deodorant because it's perfumes. And you're like, I'll tell you what's a real perfume if I don't wear deodorant. That's a... So am I attached to perfuming myself because I wear deodorant? No, I make an executive decision that, you know, I don't want to be somebody who smells bad, so I wear deodorant. Most of it is perfume, so be it, then it's going to be a perfume deodorant. But attachment, that's not what attachment is. Attachment is when you're doing something in the mind, you can feel your mind being drawn out of it, being drawn into some kind of becoming, what we call becoming or bhava. So you're talking to somebody and they say something that's against your viewpoint, and then you feel that welling up inside yourself that you just want to tell them your viewpoint. You want to convince them of your viewpoint. You feel that feeling come up. And I see it when I'm talking to people, because I'm quite good at this Slayer practice now. And when I'm talking to people, I can see when, while we're talking, they just have this upwelling, and I just stop and I let them go. You know, I don't try and get my viewpoint out before they get theirs out, because I can see it. I can see them like, yeah. And then they want to dump their viewpoint on you. Actually, that's normal for people, but so when I see them doing that, I can just stop. When I see it in myself, somebody says something to me. For example, one person told me, monks should not drink coffee because it's attachment and it's addictive, so it's breaking the precepts. And I can tell you, we monks have very definite views about drinking coffee. And I feel this upwelling, like, I want to shake this man, like, don't be so foolish, you know. Drinking coffee is not going to ruin your mindfulness. And besides, it's allowed in the Vinaya, and it's like, I can feel the upwelling, I just want to tell him. And I'm mindful of that. And I can feel, when something comes up in the present moment, and it really draws you in, that's attachment. That's when you're attaching. So then I'm mindful of that, and I step back. And I allow the feeling to be there until it dissipates. And then I'm not attached. Then this man can say what he likes about coffee. Doesn't bother me. I'm still going to have my coffee. So I asked you earlier about going to the dentist, right? Whether you like going to the dentist or you dislike it. Now, my father had a sweet shop, so you can imagine how many times I went to the dentist as a kid. All my teeth were crowded, so every tooth that came out, every milk tooth that came out, I had to have taken out under gas. Right? None of my teeth came out on their own. They all had to be extracted, and they gave you gas. And that was just horrible. They just, like, gas mask put on you. And I mean, it's a horror story. I mean, it's really horrific. So I didn't like dentists. I never liked dentists. And as soon as I'm walking into the dentist or even thinking about it, even making the appointment, I'm like, you know, I don't want to go. I don't want to be there. I don't want to wait. I don't want to sit in the chair. I don't want to talk to him. Actually, in Thailand, I have female dentists. Another thing that people say, oh, monks shouldn't ever be touched by women. And you're like, yeah, but my dentist is really good. So she just has this really delicate kind of, even when she's giving you injection, you can hardly feel it. And the guy dentist, you know, he used to be a blacksmith in his former lifetime. So, no, I'm going to have this lady dentist do my teeth. So then, if you're really mindful, see, if you're working on things on a lifetime level, do I like the dentist or not? Am I attached? Am I not attached? Do I have desires or not have desires? Is it good? Is it bad? All of that doesn't make any more sense when you're practicing Dharma. When you're practicing Dharma, you only see what's coming up right here, right now. And as I go and sit in the waiting room, it's all right. It's quiet. I'm not suffering. Nothing bad's happening to me. Why am I disliking my trip to the dentist? It's all right. You read a magazine, you look through it, it's all right. I'm not in pain. Then I go through and I sit in the chair, say hello to the dentist, and they, you know, swap a few pleasantries. And normally I'll be like, just shut up and get on with it. Just like, but it's all right. I'm not in any pain or discomfort. Then when you're sitting in the dentist chair and she starts poking around, again, still, I haven't felt anything unpleasant. And I'm wondering, why do I dislike going to the dentist so much? When you're looking on a moment-to-moment level, there's no such thing as going to the dentist. There's just this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. Then she starts with the drill. Now, that bit I don't like. But even then, I can feel my mind attaching to it and detaching from it. I had this one dentist in England, and he used to play the radio while he's doing your teeth. And he'd play this one radio channel. You have all kinds of different songs on it, but while he's just about to get started on my teeth, they had Bat Out of Hell was playing. You know, this, what was it called? Bat Out of Hell was Meatloaf. So it's kind of like a, do you know the song? You don't know? It's kind of like a heavy metal song, like hard rock. And he's just about to start on my teeth. I said, you just wait until you get something nice on the radio before you... You know, get Doris Day on the radio, then you can drill my teeth, you know. And what I found is, while he's drilling my teeth, if I put my attention on what he's doing, I start to really suffer. It starts to get really painful. But if I put my attention onto the radio, I can hardly even feel what he's doing to my teeth. Just every so often my attention jumps back to teeth, painful, unpleasant radio. And so I played with this and played switching my attention around. And you only suffer when you're putting your attention onto something. So out of the whole trip to the dentist, I probably had 2,000 moments of mindfulness. Probably only 100 of those moments was actually unpleasant. The rest of the time was actually all right. Rinsing your mouth out, going down on the chair and all the rest of it. So now, do I like going to the dentist or don't I? I've got no answer. You know, some points of it, obviously a little bit unpleasant, but most of it is perfectly okay. And I actually like leaving the dentist and having had it done, and I feel that kind of relief. The last thing they did, I went to have a crown put on, like an onlay, and they cut most of your tooth out and they put a crown on it, because it's been giving me pain. And I wanted to have the root canal and a palladium post put in. And I put this off for a year. My tooth was really painful. And I had to eat on this side of my mouth for a year. But I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go to the dentist. Still caught in that disliking. And when I got there, he looked at it. And this was a guidance guy. And he looked at it and said, I don't think you need to do a root canal. I'm like, I'm gone. I'm out of here. That's all you needed to say. And they actually put a steel band around the tooth. He said the tooth had cracked. So they made a steel band and they fitted the steel band over it to hold the tooth together, and that doesn't hurt anymore. So now I'm debating whether I actually go and have the band taken off and a crown, or whether I just leave it as it is. So if you're only working with what is arising in the present moment, this is the practice, and this is to exemplify. Because this is an abstract concept, to exemplify this theory or this idea, I'm going to tell you the story of the queen who covered her kingdom with leather. Because I said to you earlier, well, you'll remember what I said to you earlier. So one time there was a queen, and she lived very happily and very nicely in her palace, and she was pampered, and she had everything that she wanted. And then one day, when she left the palace, she would decided to go for a walk, and she left the palace, and as she did so, she stubbed her toe, and she was a little angry that she'd stubbed her toe, and it was painful. So she called her minister over, and she said to the minister, I want you to cover my entire kingdom with leather so that I'll never stub my toe again, right? So you know what the wise minister said to her, right? He said to her, oh, your majesty, what a fabulous idea. But maybe if we just cover your foot with leather, that might be a better solution. And I told you earlier, I was going to tell you how shoes were invented. This is how shoes came about. So what is the meaning of that story then? The queen wanted to fix the entire kingdom, but it's impossible. Same for you. You can't fix your life. You can't let go of all attachment in your life. You'll be an irresponsible parent, irresponsible son, irresponsible human being if you even tried to let go of all attachment in your life. Try to let go of all desire in your life. You couldn't do it. You couldn't do it for half an hour, let alone in your life. You know, sooner or later, you need to go to the bathroom. And, you know, you can't live without desire. It's impossible. But you can fix the point of contact. And the point of contact is what is arising right here, right now. With that, you can practice letting go of desire letting go of attachment just in the present moment. You still have attachments in your life, and I've suggested to you that we call these aspirations. So you still have the aspiration to be a good person, aspiration to meditate, the aspiration to look after your children, etc. But the point of contact is where you generate the practice. So the queen who wanted to cover her kingdom of leather, just that point of contact between the feet and the ground, that's the only part that she needed to really worry about. So that's the same with the life. If you're doing mindfulness, you're interrupting these thought processes, these automated processes that govern your life. You keep interrupting it until you have the sense of simply being in the present moment. If you're in the present moment, you fundamentally changes your attitude towards life. Now you're no longer going down, like we have these like hour-long chanting sessions, and I think it's too long. And it's too hot because we have all these robes and robes and robes on, and it's in Thailand, there's no aircon, and it's too hot. So for a long while I disliked it, but now I see that I get down and I dislike it for a minute, then I like it and I get inspired. Then I'm too busy trying to remember the chant to worry about whether I like it or dislike it. Then I'm thinking about the guy next to me, he's got a good voice, and the guy behind me, he's out of tune or something. So what, do I like chanting or not? That, it's no longer relevant. You're no longer looking at your life in terms of these concepts. You're looking at just what happens right in the present moment. Just the point of contact, which is exactly in the present moment. That's the part where you start to let go of the attachment, let go of desire, let go of suffering. It becomes very clear then what you need to do in the present moment. Now, where does that practice take you? Because we're not giving life, you know, this is the way you should live your life, and this is how to fix your life, this is what you should believe, this is what you should disbelieve. All we're doing is suggesting that you maintain your awareness in the present moment, your point of contact. Where that takes you is up to you. So I'm going to finish today, and actually finish my trip to Singapore for this time, with a little very short story, because again, stories exemplify things and they're easier to remember. This is a story of Nasruddin, and Nasruddin the Mullah, and he's a Sufi character, and he always does stupid things, but they always have a point of wisdom to the foolishness. And one day Nasruddin's donkey escaped, and Nasruddin went tearing off after his donkey to catch his donkey. And while he's tearing through the village chasing his donkey, one of the villagers said to him, "Nasruddin, where are you going?" And he said, "I don't know, you have to ask the donkey." So this practice, just bringing yourself into the present moment. We're not offering solutions to parenthood, childhood, work and all the rest of it. We're offering the practice just to keep you in the present moment. Where that takes you is where it takes you. You just trust in that practice. Okay, so that's it. I've stopped, finished, until...
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.